This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. Annie here, and g'day, Tobias. How are you?
Yeah, good.
You're dealing with all the all that slothful work that students have to do in order to continue to be students, because, you know, we all know that you just sleep all day.
It's really fun, though. I have to say it is really fun, even though it is really tiring.
But, it's really hard work, huh?
It meant that I had to go get half wet pants from the line today and warm them on the way into work by sitting on them.
Because you're so busy. You're so busy. That's, I always thought it was really funny. You know, people have this idea that students just lay about. But whenever you're being a student, it's incredibly hard work.
Yeah, but look, I'm grateful for my teachers, especially wrapping up this year. It's been a really good first year to go back as a mature age student. I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to student debt forgiveness, hopefully,
in
my lifetime.
In your lifetime, that's about right. It's a great boon to be learning, isn't it?
It is. It is, and especially even during this program, all the reading that I do. Or that we all do for collecting the headlines, just learn so much.
Yeah, but it's a bit mind-blowing, isn't it? There's always so many things to be able to talk about. One of the ones that I wanted to talk about today was the state's abuse of children using the legal justice system as cover. You will, of course, know about the Victorian government's adult time for violent crime. VACCO, the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, is deeply disappointed and angered by the Victorian government's latest adult time for violent crime announcement. The new policy would allow children as young as 14 to be treated as adults in the court system, continuing a worrying trend from the Victorian government, which has moved away from its previous commitment to raise the age of criminal responsibility. Aboriginal children in Victoria are already disproportionately represented in the youth justice system, and VACCO has consistently maintained that keeping children in contact with the criminal justice system only deepens intergenerational trauma and disadvantage. The government's announcement, Labor government's announcement, comes despite years of expert advice, international human rights standards and clear evidence from the community that early intervention works.
And that's with the CLP party as well in Darwin, which is, we're talking about the Gough Whitlam dismissal. What Gough Whitlam found through his reforms was that the federal government, because of the structure of Australia through the years, only has the ability to action immediate change in the territories that it directly administers, so the ACT and the Northern Territory. So there's a Labor, there's a state Labor government here that is willing to put 14-year-olds in prison, and there's a federal Labor government that's happy to see a country Liberal Party put 10-year-olds in prison in the Northern Territory.
Well, if we go up that part of the country, the Queensland Youth Detention Report confirms what Sisters Inside has said for decades: our children are being tortured. The Sisters Inside condemns the torture and human rights violations revealed in the 2025 Youth Detention Centre Inspection Report released by the Queensland Ombudsman, which confirms what they have been saying for decades. Children in Queensland's youth prisons are being abused, isolated and harmed by the state. The report details children being held in solitary confinement for extended periods, a practice the department continues to sanitise by calling it separation. This linguistic gymnastics fools no one. Solidarity confinement by any name is solitary confinement, said Debbie Kilroy, CEO of Sisters Inside. The report also documents partially clothed searches, in inverted commas, another euphemism designed to obscure the truth. Sisters Inside calls these practices what they are, state-sanctioned strip searches and sexual assaults of children, said Debbie Kilroy. For decades, Sydney Sisters Inside has warned governments that children's prisons are inherently violent institutions where abuse is not an aberration, it is the everyday operating environment. This report confirms exactly that. There was a very, very disturbing thing that happened that underlines the racist policies within the framework of the justice system in relation to children. You might have caught up with it. It was Lydia Thorpe sent out a release about it. Come Point apprehension of Aboriginal boys shows institutional police racism, she says. The incident happened last week in which a young Aboriginal boy was wrongfully apprehended at gunpoint by ACT police officers, pinned face down on the ground and held with knees on his back, causing him pain and difficulty breathing. And this was from a bus. He was on a bus, right? Can you imagine? Now, just imagine yourself being on that bus, right?
And if anything that we say is obviously triggering to you, you can call 13YARN, 139276 if you're mob, or if not, you can also call Lifeline 131114.
She says, my heart goes out to this family. I feel your pain. And to the young fella, know that you are loved. You did nothing wrong and our community stands with you. We will not let this be swept aside. Hearing about this made me feel sick. I think about my nephews. I think about all the black boys and young people in my life. Our people cannot feel safe when police see our children as threats before they see them as kids. Pretty poor stuff, eh?
Well, when we're going pretty much all the way across the country, and we have even friend of the show, Jerry Georgiados, is about to release a book on Cleveland Dodd, who people will remember was the 16-year-old Yamaji boy that died in the custody of the WA Corrective Services as it was detaining him in an adult prison. This is all about the institutionalization of these structures that, one, say that they're going to rehabilitate people but are actually just holding pens. Cleveland was found unresponsive in his cell early morning on the 12th of October 2023. The child's cell was located in Unit 18, a wing of the maximum security adult Casuarina prison. So this is an institutional problem at every level of government and something that people need to be not only aware of but actively fighting against.
Well, if we go back to the Queensland report from the Ombudsman, and what the Sisters Inside are asking for, this is what they believe. The Ombudsman's findings mirror what criminalised children and their families have been telling Sisters Inside for years. Children held in isolation in filthy bare rooms without toilets. Children subjected to dangerous restraint practices. Children denied education, culture, connection and care. Children left without meaningful human contact. Children disproportionately Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. This is not youth justice. This is cruelty masquerading as governance, and you cannot reform torture, says Debbie Kilroy. They demand that they should stop these practices in order to turn the situation around in solitary confinement, what's called administrative separation immediately. ban all strip searches, including so-called, inverted commas, partially closed searches, remove harmful restraint practices and hold staff accountable, mandate transparent public reporting of all restrictive practices, embed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander governance across all decision-making, and above all, commit to closing children's prisons for good. There is no humane way to run a children's prison. Torture cannot be regulated. It must be abolished, they say.
Absolutely right. And, I mean, on the other end of world news, the Iranian oil workers launched a historic strike this week. From the deaths of Dropsite News, 15,000 workers went on strike at a major gas field in Iran last week, demanding improved wages and working conditions at the economically critical South Pars field. Earlier this month, the Association of Gas Industry Workers, a union of Bushehr Province, the largest labour organisation representing the workers of Iran's gas refineries, announced a weekly work stoppage over long-standing grievances. Now, the incredible thing, or perhaps not incredible, but just in the context of Australian unionism, the incredible thing was that, yes, they are workers that have long supported capital and been exploited for it, but they're also rallying around. They made an explicit call that they're rallying around the people of Yemen, the people of Palestine, the people of Lebanon as well, not only because it is of a faith, but because it's a moral duty. And the spokesperson, Meg Afri, was saying, because it is also, we want to understand that we want people to understand that our interests are intertwined.
That's fascinating, isn't it? Because just as an aside, the US have launched a series of airstrikes in Somalia, which it means that they can't be more right in the sense that everybody, all workers, are fair game against this armed capitalist madness that's going on at the moment in this world. On a more local level, in union news, the Financial Services Union has commenced a fair work dispute against the ANZ Bank over the significant workplace health and safety concerns that it says has stemmed from the ANZ's massive redundancy plans. The bank aims to slash the jobs of 3,500 employees and 1,000 contractors by September 2026, with most of the 3,500 employee positions projected to go by the end of March. That's after Christmas present. The bank's poor handling and communication of the process has led to workers reportedly experiencing psychosomatic symptoms such as stomach pains, headaches and muscle tensions, with employees reporting anxiety that is spreading negatively into their family life. Surprise, surprise. This is at the same time, it might be added, that despite redundancies, related costs and a $240 million ATSIC fine for, inverted commas, widespread misconduct related to incorrectly reporting bond trading data to the government, ignoring hundreds of customers' hardship notices and failing to refund fees charged to thousands of dead customers, and ANZAC's full-year profits still reach $5.7 billion. An ANZ spokesperson said the redundancies were part of a number of changes as it focuses on its refreshed ANZ 2030 strategy.
Absolutely appalling. And
I mean, if it wasn't so terrible, it would be.
I know, it's absolutely satirical, yeah. I'll just do the quick report, because the Dropsite collected a bunch of information this week about the genocide, the ongoing genocide in Gaza. A series of Israeli attacks on Gaza City and Khan Yunis on Wednesday killed at least 33 Palestinians, including 12 children and 8 women, and injured 88, Al Jazeera reported. A family of five was killed when a strike hit a residential building in Gaza City's Zaytun neighborhood, while other attacks in the city left more than 10 people dead, according to Gaza Civil Defense. Israel pushed westward into eastern Gaza City on Thursday, advancing tanks and moving the yellow concrete barriers that marked the ceasefire withdrawal line, roughly 300 meters into Al-Tufa and Al-Shujaiya neighborhoods, after strikes a day earlier killed dozens of Palestinians. Then in the UN, Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese in a statement said that the Security Council's recent ceasefire solution, quote, runs counter to the Palestinian right to self-determination, end quote, arguing it cements external control over Gaza's government, governance, borders, security, and reconstruction, while ignoring Israel's, quote, ongoing unlawful siege, occupation, racial segregation, and apartheid, end quote. She said that the U.S.-chaired Board of Peace would impose American and Israeli prerogatives and leave Palestinians under, quote, a puppet administration, end quote, insisting any international presence must ensure Israel's withdrawal from the Strip, protect civilians, and support the right of Palestinians to determine their own political future.
And before we go on to Voices for Palestine, I recommend a film, Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. It's now showing at Nova. It's a film that's been put together by Iranian director Sifateh Farsi. It's based around her year-long conversations over mobile phone. It's an extraordinary film. It's a conversation with Fatma Hossani, a young photojournalist and poet who... and they speak to each other over a year. And this is what the film chronicles, until the death of Fatma and her six members of her family as they slept by the Israelis. It's the most extraordinary film because, one, we see this person, a real Gazan, as she communicates to the world, and we see her family members. And it's important for people to remember that these are real people. And what Israel is doing is unconscionable. It could be you.
It's a government's job to protect Australia's forests and oceans. But too often, governments put the interests of big corporations ahead of protecting your health, your climate, and your children's future. The Albanese government is about to change Australia's nature law. While this might seem like telling them how to suck eggs, we expect laws that actually protect nature by closing deforestation loopholes and protecting threatened species. It's literally their job. Head to wilderness.org.au/suckeggs to learn more. The Wilderness Society is a 3CR supporter.
You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Tabea, and we're going to the Sydney rally that was held on the 16th of November, given to us by our compatriot Vivian Langford, who is from the Climate Action Show, which you can catch at 5 p.m. on Mondays on 3CR. She has collected together a couple of voices. One in particular begins the... piece. It's Yassan. He's a Sudanese activist. He brings the story of what's going on in Sudan to our attention, and there is a eerie similarity to what's going on in Palestine. The rally has made room for the Sudanese struggle, because they see, just as the indigenous struggle in Australia is the same colonial project that is happening in all these lands across the world. It follows with Joel Gaya, who is an American activist who's been fighting for the Palestinian story to reach the stage, the attention of people from since 1967, as he points out. But here's the report.
As as we do fight for justice in Palestine, we also should not forget our brothers and sisters in Sudan right now fighting a very similar battle. Because our fight for Palestine is a fight against colonialism in all its forms. It's a fight against fascism, against racism, against neocolonialism and imperialism. And we've said this before, but none of us are free until we are all free. Yasser, who is a Sudanese activist, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Please welcome Yasser.
It's now been 946 days of Sudan's war. 946 days of murder, genocide, rape, and torture of the Sudanese civilians by two armed militias, the SAF and the RSF. Two wings of a counter-revolutionary war against the people of Sudan. Sudan's war of the last 2 years is not a forgotten or silent war. It is a war of atrocities, starvation, bombardment, and displacement, fueled by the multiple regional and international imperialist forces, including the United States, Israel, the European Union, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. The UAE in particular is a US ally and weapons buyer. It has been materially supporting the RSF in their genocidal campaign. Australia engages in arms deals with both Saudi Arabia and UAE and has persistently rejected calls from the UN and humanitarian bodies to ban sales arms to these countries. Just like the weapons parts this country manufactures to murder people in Gaza, the weapons exports to countries like the UAE make Australia complicit in this counter-revolutionary and genocidal war. They represent but another arm of imperialism. The Rapid Support Forces' ethnic cleansing in Darfur in West Sudan and Kurdufan in Central Sudan is possible because the UAE funds, arms, and protects them. In Darfur, 99,128 people and counting have been displaced from El-Fashir and surrounding villages since the 26th of October. In Kurdufan, Bara, the Rapid Support Forces executed dozens of civilians after reclaiming the city, and the thousands who fled the violence are suffering from acute hardship, from displacement, and a shortage of basic necessities, food, clothing, and medicine. And this is true for a lot of Sudan. This hellish, systematic violence is a result of all the wars Sudan has endured, marked by barbarity and the failure to bring perpetrators to justice. Impunity has never been an exception. Rather, it is a central reason for the recurrence of these crimes. The ongoing absence of accountability has recreated an environment that allows the return of war crimes and genocide against the populations of cities and villages as soon as the regime's forces, the SAF, retreat. We also emphasize, as the Sudanese people, that the failure to secure unarmed civilians and the withdrawal of the army from the steadfast city of El-Fashir for months in the face of the Janjaweed militia, the RSF, is an irresponsible act deserving condemnation and accountability. The primary and most important duty of a nation's army is to protect its citizens and the homeland, not to protect itself and its interests. The systematic and persistent targeting of pro-democracy actors is a defining feature of Sudan's war, exposing its deeper nature as a counter-revolution against Sudan's democratic aspirations. This counter-revolutionary war and its movement is a crackdown on civic spaces to eliminate civilian-led governance. While they may differ in tactics and motivations, both the SAF and RSF share an interest in suppressing this counter-revolutionary agenda. Explains why civilians are consistently targeted wherever they are by SAF and RSF. And these attacks against civilians have spiked either as punishment or for allegedly collaborating with either group. The war is both a counter-revolutionary war against the Sudanese people, but also an imperialist scheme aimed at weakening the Sudanese state and creating conditions for disintegration and division to deplete the capabilities of the people, to deplete the wealth of the country, and to violate national sovereignty. This political and economic dimension of the war, local, regional, and international, places a double responsibility on the international community, that's us, to intervene immediately to stop this war and these massacres. We demand an immediate ceasefire, the declaration of a humanitarian truth, and a complete opening of humanitarian corridors to Al-Fashir and other areas of Darfur, Bara, and all of North Kurduvan and South Kurduvan, ensuring the protection of aid convoys. We demand a quick, independent, and transparent international investigation into war crimes and to hold accountable all who committed, ordered, or contributed to these crimes. We demand urgent action from the peoples of the world, its democratic forces, and human rights organizations to pressure states and international bodies to halt any support or political or military complicity with the parties responsible for these actions. That includes forcing Australia to stop being complicit in genocide by immediately ceasing the exportation of weapons and or weapon parts to the United Arab Emirates. 90% of Sudan's gold is being sent to the UAE. The UAE has no gold mines. Their gold trade is predicated on the exploitation and the massacres of Sudan and exploited countries in Africa. From Gaza to Darfur, stop the killing, stop the war. From Gaza to Darfur, stop the killing, stop the war.
Stop the killing, stop the war.
From Gaza to Darfur, stop the killing, stop the war.
From Gaza to Darfur, stop the killing, stop the war.
Free the people, free the land.
Free the people, free the land.
We demand a free Sudan.
We demand a free Sudan.
Free the people, free the land.
I first got involved in the struggle to free Palestine, for a liberated Palestine, in 1967 in the Six-Day War. We were totally isolated then. We had virtually no support. It's been a long slog since then. And I would like to say what I believe the movement here and internationally has accomplished in the last 2 years. We were not able to end a genocide war, but we have done a number of things, I believe, that are great accomplishments as a result of these demonstrations here and in Sydney and internationally. The first of which is Palestine has become again a political issue. They cannot hide it. They cannot attempt to organize the Middle East with the so-called Abraham Accords of the United States and Israel and Saudi Arabia, creating a Middle East in which Palestine does not exist. That's what they wanted to do before this war broke out, okay? The second thing that I think we have accomplished is we have won the battle for public opinion internationally. 2 years ago when this war started, most people were supportive or sympathetic to Israel. It has been an enormous change. Throughout the world, tens of millions of people are now pro-Palestinian and for the liberation of Palestine. And that did not exist 2 years ago. And that is a result of both the horror of this genocidal war and the resistance in Palestine and here in Sydney and internationally in the work that you have done to make this an issue, to make this war an issue. You have won tens of millions of people throughout the world. And you have won millions of people to take part in demonstrations here in Australia and internationally. Your demonstration of 300,000 people a little while back was an enormous accomplishment, not just for yourself, but it gave strength for the movement internationally. They saw what was going on here. They felt stronger, just as we felt stronger when they upped the ante with a general strike in Italy, with strikes in Spain and Greece and so on. tens of millions of people, I shouldn't say tens, millions of people throughout the world have taken part as a result of these demonstrations. I think that one of the most important things that has been accomplished is because of the strength of this movement internationally, because the Palestinians continue to resist, because of the change in public opinion, what they wanted to do about Gaza and the West Bank only a couple of months ago has been pushed back, at least temporarily. The American government, Trump's government, said, we want to turn Gaza into a beautiful real estate. The Israelis want to carry out a second Nakba and get the population out of Gaza. The Americans had come out for the Israelis annexing the West Bank. All of that has been turned on its head in the last couple of months. They have stepped back from that, at least temporarily. Partially, it's because American imperialism has gotten everything it wants in the Middle East. It now controls the Middle East, and when the Israelis bombed Qatar, their Arab allies, Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, said, either you discipline Israel, or we are going to look for other alliances with China and elsewhere. So the Americans stepped in, and they said very simply to the Israelis, we run things. Trump announced, we decide, not Israel. Israel is just their military puppet. The Americans decide, and they decided that they're no longer for the annexation of the West Bank, at least this year. They're no longer for displacing the Gaza population. You have to have a ceasefire, you have to make peace, etc. Because they've gotten everything they've wanted out of it. We don't know whether this ceasefire will hold. But for us, there is no ceasefire. Not for what we want, which is to liberate Palestine. We are not signing up for a ceasefire. We will continue this struggle until Palestine is liberated. We will fight, we will organize, we will educate, we will continue to demonstrate, and we will build this movement internationally.
Stop, stop the genocide!
Stop, stop the genocide!
Stop, stop the genocide!
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Yeah! 3CR Community Radio, giving voice to the community since 1976.
And you're back with Annie and Tobias. What was that piece of wildness?
That was local band Useless Children. I want a bit of a tip to showcase some of the best that this country's got to offer in terms of alternative music.
And on the line we've got Mary Beck councillor Sue Bolton. G'day, Sue. How are you?
Great. How's it going?
It's fine. We've got you in here because Infrastructure Victoria has called for the Victorian government to duplicate and extend the upfilled train line. But it's not just that, is it? It's all about the north of Melbourne needing proper services and the government really letting the side down.
Absolutely. And the community in the north, or series of communities in the north, have been calling for this for... You right?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, sorry. I thought there was something funny with the noise. The communities in the north have been calling for this for many years. And
I
then
think
we
it's
set
a
up
decade,
a campaign in... Yeah, decades. It's been happening, this campaign. But there hadn't really been an actual campaign for a while until we set up the Upfield Transport Alliance in 2017, which united people in the Broadmeadows area, Faulkner, Coburg, Brunswick, and further south, because we were sort of working on the basis that we needed to unite everybody and not just... have a solution that looked after people in the southern part of the line, because everyone's futures are really connected by having a decent train line for everybody. And there were various schemes put forward of maybe just increasing the service as far as Coburg. But we always rejected that because we wanted to see a solution for everybody on the line, and the people in the northern end of the line suffer the worst impact with the train cancellations. So it's great now that the councils in the north have actually taken up this demand, which was not the case when we started the campaign. And it's great that that the Infrastructure Victoria has taken this up, including calling for two new train stations at Campbellfield and Beveridge, where real live people live and work. And need to visit and need public transport that they can get on and off with the station. But the interesting thing is the government's response is that they're fixing the upfield line by doing level crossing removal in Brunswick, which that won't fix the line unless trains can fly over the top of each other at the northern end, because a single track at the northern end means that as soon as a train is running 6 minutes late, it gets cancelled.
Oh, my God.
Because trains can't pass each other in the single track at the northern end of the line. You need a duplicated track for trains to be able to pass each other.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you put it into actual context, as a person waiting for a train, if you're going to work, if you're actually going to an appointment, if you're actually a student trying to get to classes, if you're just an ordinary person trying to get from one side of the city to the other, that can translate to having to wait 40 minutes for a train. That's untenable.
Or even an hour at peak hour.
At peak
like
hour.
If two trains are cancelled one after the other, you have to wait basically an hour for a train at peak hour.
And
so this is scandalous.
It's scandalous because, but it actually goes further than that if people want to put it into context. We're talking about the northern part of the city, which is... the government's actually started, expanding the amount of housing estates that are being developed out that way. So instead of actually having services, which have been on the public record as a plan for something like 30 years, they're expecting to create a large housing developments out there without services.
No, that's absolutely right.
Right, I'm not wrong there, right?
No. They're planning, there are going to be tens of thousands of people, equivalent to really a whole city, being, moved to the northern suburbs. Mirrabeck Council alone is scheduled by the state government to grow by, I know, 30 to 50,000 people over the next, 10 years or so. And then their plans for big housing estates on the outskirts, Wallen and so forth, and Beveridge and places like that, but also Broadmeadows, Campbellfield. There's a lot of development happening all over the city, not just in the inner city and not just on the far outskirts, but in between as well. And this is crazy because that they won't fix up these services because, say, if you look at the Upfield line, there's no alternative route, public transport route to the city other than the train line.
Yep.
If you live from Bakers Road further south, from North Coburg further south, you have an access to a tram line. Not that the tram necessarily takes you everywhere, but you actually have a second public transport link. In the north, you don't have any alternative way of getting to the city. And we've met people when we're doing petitioning and so forth at the stations. We met people who knew people who'd lost jobs because they couldn't get to work on time every day. God. We've met people who've missed important medical appointments. We've missed people who've missed important final year exams for VCE students. We've met, it's when I first raised this issue on council, council regarded as maybe a bit of an inconvenience. Well, it's not an inconvenience, it's life changing. If you don't get a job you're hanging out for, if you've been long term unemployed or whatever the situation is, this can have really terrible consequences for people.
Yeah, now let's get to the next part of it, which is that the government is actually creating an apartheid system, effectively, in the public transport realm in Melbourne. One side of the city is being, which is seen to be a more wealthy section of the city, the southeast, is being serviced very well, while people on the other side are not being serviced well at all. And the reliance on a car is being built into the fabric of the northern suburbs.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that because, if you can't access public transport, even if you can't afford a car, you'll borrow money to get a car. That's absolutely what will happen. And people just give up on using public transport if it's too unreliable. And then public transport becomes a residual system for those who, have physical conditions where they just can't drive or they absolutely have zero money to be able to have a car or whatever. And so then the governments can disregard the people who need to use public transport. But where there is a big issue is that people often in the inner city who run various campaigns for safer streets, to get traffic off their streets, etc., the living conditions of people in the inner city who might be struggling with too much traffic in their streets is intimately connected to the fact of the lack of public transport in the outskirts of the city. So actually all of our futures are entwined, even though politicians like to play communities against each other depending on where they're elected and so forth. And really the city and all the traffic safety issues and all the rest of it, as well as the need for mass public transport, are really all, they're all integrated. And I used to be a bus driver in Brisbane a long time ago. And when I came on the job, there was still a small number of bus drivers on the job who came from the days when there was a big strike in Brisbane at the end of the 60s to keep trams on the road. Because in that era, in the 60s, Australia was following the Los Angeles model. And the Los Angeles model was to destroy public transport to force workers to buy cars. And in Brisbane, the first lot of bus drivers who were ex-tram drivers, because the strike was defeated when somehow a fire broke out at the depot and only burnt the trams, not the buses parked beside them. So the first lot of Brisbane bus drivers didn't have a car licence, because in those days a lot of workers didn't own cars. And so what that shows, it's nothing to do with what some of the active transport people say, where they say, people are driving because they've got access to free parking. No, they had to destroy public transport to force workers into individualised transport, which is a car.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly correct. The Infrastructure Victoria's costed the duplicating of the 4 kilometre of track, and we should put this in clear statement, that duplicating 4 kilometres of track is going to have incredible effects on for people's lives. It's going to cost upgrading power and signalling between North Melbourne and Upfield. They calculate it's going to cost $650 million to $1.4 billion, which sounds like a big amount, but actually the return on each of the dollars spent, they calculate, will be $1.90. So it's almost a doubling of return of the investment.
Well, I think it can be compared, actually, to the suburban rail loop, which in a lot of ways I love the idea of, because I love the idea of being able to travel not just into the city but across the city east-west by train. But this is tunnelling heaps and heaps of kilometres to build a rail line. It's, $30 billion plus. Meanwhile, there are a whole lot of smaller public transport issues, such as duplicating the Upfield line, which, as you say, will really radically improve people's lives, and they refuse to spend on them, possibly because the suburban rail loop project is possibly connected more with opening up land for land developers, and that could be an alternative motive for the suburban rail loop. Whereas, for ordinary people, we need the Upfield line duplicated, and there's similar projects in other parts of Melbourne as well. But my understanding is the Upfield train line is the only train line with a single track at the end where there is no plan by the government to actually duplicate to fix the issue. I think, from my understanding, I might be wrong in this, but I think everywhere else where there's a single track on part of a train line or at the end of a train line, they've got they're either dealing with the issue or they have plans to fix the issue.
Yeah, and that, because we have to finish up, you've just pointed out something very important, which is a lot of the government's improvements, inverted commas, or for public transport, is often spending disguised as public transport spending, but is really the stated aim of the program is to reduce congestion on the roads, which means that it's focused on cars, not on public transport.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely the case. And that's the government's response in this instance, to say, oh, we're fixing the line by doing a removing level crossings. Well, that won't fix the issues on the Upfield line one little bit.
Yeah. Thanks very much for talking to us. It's a watching brief, isn't it? The pushback against the government's plans, this report is just the beginning or the middle or never the end of this fight.
No, absolutely. Mm. No, thanks for the call about this issue.
But I won't be sworn at and I won't be bossed around. That includes them, the big bosses. They won't be washing me around either. I will find a way.
Rents are through the roof. The cost of living is skyrocketing and public housing is under attack. How do we fight back? Join us on Wednesday, the 26th of November from 6 p.m. at RMIT University's City Campus for From Housing Crisis to Dwelling Justice, a free public event that gets to the heart of the housing struggle. Featuring the premiere of Bay Views for All, a documentary about the fight to save the Barrack Beacon public housing estate, and a panel discussion with public housing residents, activists, and experts. This is one you won't want to miss. Register for a free ticket at events.humanitix.com/crisis-2-justice.
It's never occurred to them they've actually got something valuable here.
Hands off public housing. A 3CR supporter.
You're with Annie and Tobiah on Solidarity Breakfast on 3CR, your community radio station, and we're going to go to a short interview I did with filmmakers Timothy and Tristan Kenyon, who have made a film called Changing Track. It focuses on the Paralympic cycling team that went off to Paris in 2024, but it's much more than that. And it highlights the coming up screenings on December the 3rd, which is the International Day of Disability. But there's going to be a film screening at the Lido in Hawthorne on the 26th, which you might want to look up. There's going to be a Q&A with some of the people in the film as well as the filmmakers. So this is just a little bit of a conversation that I had with the two guys.
Thank you very much for talking to me about the film, Changing Track. So how did you guys begin this process? Because it's must have been a long time in the planning.
So, to go back to the very beginning, 25 years ago, Tim and I went to the Paralympic Games in Sydney 2000. I was probably about 15 years old at the time. I was going through some depression at that point. I had some quite severe cystic acne, and I was on a medication. In fact, both Tim and I were both on the same medication, Roaccutane, which of course had the side effect of depression. So had, you know, you double up there with the depression. So going to the Paralympic Games was such an amazing moment, just watching athletes from all around the world achieve amazing things despite their disabilities. And it was really a sort of a beacon of hope and inspiration for me personally, and I think for Tim as well. Yeah, spinning forward 25 years, for the last sort of 10 years I've been working for a production company or a company called ARA, which sponsors the Australian cycling team. The executive producer, Edward Fetterman, is a big supporter of the arts and literature, and he came in and sort of, you know, I was doing all the commercials and photography and video and everything for the company, and he came in and said, hey, how can we support the Australian cycling team? And, you know, of course I flashed back to the Paralympics 25 years ago and thought, you know, let's jump on that, and gave Tim a call and, you know, asked Tim if he wanted to co-produce and co-write with me. And what did you say, Tim?
I think the first thing I thought was, what do I know about cycling? last time I was on a bike, I was 15 years old and fell off and severely broke my leg.
Oh my goodness. You don't do things by half measures, do you?
No. Well, definitely during the production of this documentary, I decided, you know, I had to get into it properly, and I broke my shoulder just to feel what Kane was feeling. So
well, it's an interesting project to be working on, because as you said, the three main protagonists, and they're not just the only people in this film, because there's a whole team of people that are part of the Paralympic cycling team. How did you decide on the three protagonists in particular? We get to understand the personalities of the people. They're quite different from each other, which is, That's even right. though they're all saved by the cycling, they set themselves challenges, and they've got such incredible levels of barriers to success. It's quite
extreme. That's right. And they all come from very different places as well. So you have Kane, who was born with albinism and suffered significant bullying going through school. You have Corey, who grew up a almost normal childhood, except for his accident when he was 10.
But also he's a wild child. I mean, it's like the person, like he stands at the edge of a cliff and he has to go for the, he loves the rush. I've met people that he just loves the rush.
Yeah. But his childhood was quite significantly took a different direction when he was a teenager from his two separate accidents. And specifically with the significant brain trauma that he encountered from his motorcycling accident. And then you have Emily, who basically her life was already on track, as she says in the film. She was all set up. She had her own business. She was had her own home. She had her whole life mapped out for herself. And then, bam, she was diagnosed with MS, and it completely derailed the whole course of her life. And so it's three very different people who have come into this world from very different angles. And we think that's a great way of showing all the different ways that people could find themselves in that dark place in their life and need to find a way out. And this film kind of tries to help show a way of finding a way out of that hole.
So Tristan, when you were coming to developing the story, it's not just about these people, it actually goes into the depths of human spirit, doesn't it? It's an encompassing element to this story.
It is, yeah. I think there's a lot in there. There's so many different things that we wanted to cover, and I think mental health is a huge part of that. You know, you talked before about, you know, not just being those three, but also the team and the support community behind that. And that's one of the things that Tim and I wanted to really highlight there as well, that, you know, in you know, for anybody watching that and an audience watching that, that, you know, finding that right community and, you know, when you're possibly in a darker place to find that community and that thing that you love. Going through and including some of those stories from such as Alistair and his, albeit quite a small section of the film, it's still a really important part and one of our favourite parts, actually, that whole sequence. He talks about, you know, writing, you know, being a helpful way for him to process things. And for him, it helped him process the loss of his father when he was 11 years old. And, you know, he'll go on the road and ride for 5 or 6 hours at a time while he's training and you know, be able to process things that's going on for him. And, Meg also talks about, you know, it being such a great thing for people to get together. And if they have trouble talking directly eye contact to others about problems, that, you know, while riding, they can do that while focusing on something as well and still be able to talk through their problems. So...
That's right. And I think we lean quite heavily into the concept of invisible disability in this film. And I think that's quite an important message. And it's talked about in the film by Eliza. You don't always know what somebody's going through. And it's important to recognize that everybody's going through something in the world, and I think there needs to be a little bit more compassion to that, not just the most obvious ones.
What did you learn about the people and disability and just the emotion of the whole thing? What was the outcome for you personally from that?
For me, going into going over to Paris, you know, as an introverted person, it's already, you know, terrifying, the idea of going and talking to, you know, anybody really that you don't already know. So let alone going and meeting, you know, world record Paralympic athletes, you know, while standing there with a camera in your hand, which is also intimidating to them. So it's, you know, it was quite a big big challenge for me. And but yeah, the community and the acceptance, and yeah, I think that's the sort of thing that I took away, which was, you know, I didn't go in with any sort of preconceived notions about disability or anything like that. But, you know, when you're, you know, these, especially Kane, Corey and Emily, we've, you know, and Luke, we've all become quite close now, and they're all just really good friends. And there is, you know, there is no disability there for us. It's just, you know, they're people and they've got challenges. We've all got challenges. That's, yeah, I guess what I feel like I've come out of it with.
I might really quickly add to that. Gordon, we did one of our screenings with Gordon the other night, and he said something quite profound, which impacted me, which was, it's so often these people are pushed as disabled athletes, and the whole disability side of it is what's pushed. But in reality, these people are athletes. They are just incredible athletes, just they've had such amazing achievements in spite of the fact that they have this disability. I think that should be celebrated.
Yeah.
And they're at a high performance level as well, just like an Olympic athlete. There's just, you know, it's just they're also dealing with these extra challenges as well. So,
well, Corey says it really, doesn't he? He says a couple of things. One is he found his people, which is absolutely imperative.
Earlier on in the film, that he says, "This doesn't define me. I don't let anything define me."
Yeah,
and
that's
right. That really resonates with me, and I think it's quite significant for anybody dealing with trauma therapy, is to focus on that. That is not your core. This is not what defines you. It's a part of you. You can't deny that, but it doesn't define you.
Tell me, you're screening it around Australia, but you must have shown it to the participants. What were their feelings? How did they feel about it?
We have done a few previews before these. We're currently doing a national Q&A tour at the moment, which is open to the public. But we have done a few previews in the lead up to this as well, and I think the response has been fantastic from the community, the team, and the support staff as well. So that was great. And the first time we showed it to the main featured athletes, Emily, Kane, Corey and Luke, was, I think, about May, was it, Tim? May?
That's right, yeah.
We flew them all to Sydney and went into Disney Studios and hired one of the big screens that, you know, Baz Luhrmann does all of his previews and everything on, and you know, treated them to watching the film just with them and their partner, just so it was a private experience for them. And it was quite a special moment. Tim and I were obviously quite nervous, but and they were quite nervous, but we all agreed that we sort of hit the mark, and they were really, really happy with how their stories were presented and the themes that we'd chosen and the way that we'd put it together.
I think we're pretty excited about the national release on the 3rd of December. We're wrapping up the Q&A tour next week in Melbourne at Lido Cinemas. But on the 3rd of December, we'll be screening the film nationally around the country in many cinemas, in capital cities and in regional areas as well.
International Day.
The three of us reckon
3CR is the best.
A weak solidarity Bricky team listener when True Blue Aussie was bemoaning losing COP 31, the annual gathering of the fossils to ensure the destruction of Mother Earth continues apace, making True Blue Aussie an appropriate, indeed an ideal host. But maybe, just maybe, there are advantages in losing the pollution talk fest, like saving the billions it would have cost and saving us from our Pacific family, as we call our sinking neighbours, from raising little matters like True Blue Aussie's role in that sinking. Meanwhile, the caring business class Hayseed and Sheepshed Party's coalition is such slow learners, failing to adapt the socialist brilliant tactic of saying all the right things and doing all the wrong things. Brilliant, apart from its impact on poor old Mother Earth. Coalition Supremo and would-be Big Supremo Sussan, Lees and Driggs explained its fossils pollution-led policy led by fossils would lower the cost of energy so we can all save money while contributing to the destruction of the planet and lower emissions, although Sussan hasn't quite explained, one, how building lots more expensive coal-fired power stations, nuclear power plants, and what to do with the waste for a couple of 100,000 years, and gas, 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 oil, 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 ad infinitum, while opposing renewable projects, will make it all cheaper, and two, how all that will reduce the emissions whose reduction they have abandoned. Perhaps she ran out of time to explain, and there must be a simple explanation for her clearly well-researched analysis as she hurriedly moved on to her next project to benefit all of us, stopping all these selfish immigrants who are stealing our homes and our jobs, with the exception of the filthy rich, if they bring their filthy riches with them. Sussan also told us she would agree to the Minister for Woodside with Profits, Murray Swatch, the environment's very smart environmental bill. Very smart because environment is a camouflage. It's all about the government's fossil mates. Very smart, apart from its impact on poor old Mother Earth. Agree with a few little inconsequential amendments like removing any bits that might inadvertently protect the environment or slow down the fossils in pursuing the transition from themselves. A very selfish full-page ad appeared Thursday, authorised by that commie front, the True Blue Aussie Institute, and signed by about 150 goody-goody black armband, wooden working and iron commie greeny organisations who clearly have no concern for the good of the fossil economy, attacking the very items in Murray's bill that Sussan says she'll support and arguing for strengthening Sussan's unacceptable bits, showing how these so-called environmental groups are so far removed from the reality that Sussan and Murray and Big Supremo Anthony Albanese and Western True Blue Aussie Supremo Roger Cook the Planet and his fossil masters understand that we must reach that proper balance between, for they are all committed to the transition from two, the long, long-term ambition from two, knowing these things can't be rushed, to striking the proper balance between the interests of the fossils and the interests of the fossils. Indeed, Sussan's willingness to compromise with a few little amendments is driven by ensuring that Murray doesn't do a deal with the reckless Greens, which we'll all agree would be a disaster, would have the foreseen disadvantages of putting some environmental protection into the Environment Protection Bill. We know the transition is a slow, slow, can't-be-rushed process because the International Energy Agency predicted global oil and gas demand will continue for the next 25 years if the world does not change course. And, of course, the fossils are at COP30 this very moment, ensuring it does not change course because that would prevent the transition which will save us all, although it mightn't be all that good for poor old Mother Earth. Oh, and Sussan came up with another big, big winner in the policy department. Spend lots and lots more on trained killing, she told that repository of radical thought, the Pig Eye and Bob Menzies Institute, and encouraging more and more young people to sign up as trained killers to defend us from we know who. In shocking, shocking news, a Lowy Institute poll showed nearly a quarter of young people said they would not defend the country. We must effect a cultural change to combat a growing lack of patriotic fervour among the young, Sussan promised. Hear, hear. What is wrong with these young people? Yes, we must make them realise the fun of being able to kill and slaughter legally. Instead of 20 years in the slot, they give you a medal. And clearly we're not spending nearly enough on the merchants of death, including that 38 mil a day and rising on those nuclear underwater thingies it's almost certain we'll never see. The only thing rising but can bathe in the knowledge we're subsidising our mother country, His Most Gracious Majesty's home country, and our father country, the US arms merchants of death, to the tune of trillions. On which Nobel Peace contender, US of the UN of the US of the world, Big Supremo Donald Trump of the poor, kept his peace campaign going with the slaughter of a few more Venezuelans on the high seas, knowing they have no right to fish their own waters. while tying up a few loose ends of the peace he achieved in Ukraine on one day back in January in a plan drawn up with peace-loving Russia. Well, Russia is right up there with the US of in the peace-loving business. Made Ukraine an offer it can't refuse. "Are you surrender?" he ordered. "Best surrender ever, ever." Knowing that if Ukraine refuses to surrender, it will prove it is not interested in peace. To balance the equation, Donald's very, very close friend, Vlad the Invader, must make the crippling concession of accepting the surrender. "It's a matter of give, 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 and take, take, take," Vlad explained. Donald's other promised day one achievement, ending the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation of the Gaza non-land, non-people, continued apace. Given Donald's very, very, very close friend Zion oversaw the peace and observed its ceasefire agreements by continuing to bomb the proverbial out of and slaughter the non-land, non-people and Lebanon and protecting its Yahweh-given land in Syria, oh, and ensuring the non-land, non-people in the West Bank know their place, which is no place. But Don, who never flows quietly, agreed with an offer he couldn't refuse to release the Jeffrey Epps sleaze files after consulting with his totally independent Attorney General, Pam Bond. "I do what he tells me," that she could redact bits that might upset some people, like, say, Donald. One thing he did tell her to do was pursue the Democrats, whom he said were all involved. Goodness! And if all those unpatriotic young people isn't enough for poor Sussan, another poll showed 37 and 36% of people respectively hadn't even heard of former train killer Andrew Hastie DeWar and fossil champion Angus Tailings, which from her point of view mightn't be so bad given they're lining up to knock her off. But then 60% of people haven't even heard of her. But from our point of view, the most hurtful result was the most unpopular polly, with a favourability rating of -23%, Barnicle. Barnicle, after all he's done for this country, both standing up and lying down. On surveys, good news for our tertiary sector. We recall that Anthony's envoy on anti-Semitism recommended a definition of anti-Semitism, decreeing any criticism of Zion to be anti-Semitic. And she has appointed former Trublowazi Catholic Uni Vice Chancellor Greg Craven to assess how unis are responding to anti-Semitism under her definition, which should guarantee a collective fail. Certainly not failing as they announce record profits, the banks, facing a Parliamentary Economic Committee hearing, socialist Polly Ed Yusek having the gall to ask them about ripping off thousands of workers. Inadvertently, of course, because they just couldn't read the very, very complicated award system correctly, but that's all in the past, they said. Sure, sure. And the witch bank, which used to be our bank, Supremo Mad, not all that Commonwealth, assured us the record profits had nothing to do with, were not contributing to, soaring house prices. In fact, he said, there were difficult times ahead for the poor banks, which should put an end to any crippling selfish claims by the lazy avaricious workforce. As selfish as the evil unions pushing for higher wages, well, livable wages, for equally selfish apprentices, claiming apprentices can't survive unless they've got family support. Often they can't afford to go to work because they can't afford to put petrol in the car. What they ignore is the pertinent point made by caring employers that the wage rise, a livable wage, would cost $100,000 over the 4 years of an apprenticeship. Do they think caring employers are made of money? Although in fairness, caring employers would be prepared to look at a higher wage if the government came to the rescue, showing deep down they really do care. It gets worse. Retailers have had to fork out more than $12 million in wage rises because of the socialist crippling and grossly unfair same job, same pay rules. We assume this doesn't mean, no it couldn't, that they had been ripping workers off to the tune of. Caring employers wouldn't do that. And tax office figures show the majority of teachers are women, but men out-earn women at every level of education. Fascinating that, because if we reckon the transition from fossils to fossils has to be taken slowly, I recall us all celebrating when the courts handed out equal pay a mere 53 years ago. So it must be getting close. Finally, and apropos of nothing item, we all appreciate how the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin gives us the most important and critical news day after day, the biggest events in the whole world, like, and this is so typical of their daily reporting, Monday, the most important news in the whole world, screaming out on P1, unhappy little Vegemites. Yes, a convicted murderer, quote, is taking the government to court, claiming denial of Vegemite breaches his human rights. What a scoop. What a biggest news of the day item. Or as Sinatra sang, start spreading the news. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Kevin. That's hilarious. And this, you're back with Annie and Tobiah, but we're also...
We're joined by more.
Yeah, Amelia, rank and file CFMU, and Casey from Koori Construction Delegate for CFMU. Hello, guys.
Hi.
Thanks.
Yep, and we're going to be talking about what's going on in the Victorian CFMEU, but also spilling over to some of the things that are going on in Queensland.
I mean, because the attack's broader, and I mean, it was only last week that you guys were here, but it seems like worlds away from, I mean, Amelia was here, but worlds away from what happened last week. Now it's just intensifying what's going on.
Yeah, it's been, like you said, really intense over the last week. We have seen at least 10 people leave our union, most of them being organisers. And one of our best organisers, Joel Shackleton, our Koori organiser. Casey, you probably have more to say about that.
Yeah, I do. It's come a real shock to our community with Joel being stood down. He came into this role 4 years ago. He was the first one, 5 years ago now, he was the first ever Indigenous organiser across the CFMEU. And he's come in, he's made waves, he's really done a great job at bridging the gap, at closing the gap of the work life within the industry and within our community. I know personally, I'm just one of hundreds of stories that could sit for hours and tell all the ways that Joel was there, from a death in the family to being bullied on site to having to deal with racist things said on site. It's just a really big blow and a complete shock still to our community today.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because the administration is being put forward as a clean sweep through the CFMEU and making it a better place and all the rest of it. But that's not really your experience as a member, isn't it? Is that, would that be fair to say?
That's absolutely fair to say. We, in the community as a whole, we are already all talking amongst ourselves. We don't understand how they could even comprehend that getting rid of Joel would be in the best interest of the Indigenous community and in the construction industry. At the end of the day, Joel has been so understanding coming into the industry. He's worked in it for 10 plus years. He knows that a big issue with dealing with the Indigenous issues within the industry isn't always racism. There's a lot of miseducation. There's a lot of ignorance. There's a lot of educating that needs to be done for the wider community to understand the struggles and the generational trauma that our community has to deal with. A lot of people don't realise. They think, oh, but all that stuff that happened to your community happened years ago. We talk about stolen generation and everything like that. That wasn't a long time ago. Myself, I'm first generation. My father was a part of the stolen generation. He was actually in one of the worst homes ever, the Ballarat Boys Home. He grew up in there, and that was only one generation ago. So he's come in and educated so many people. So it's not even just how detrimental to our community it is that he's been let go. It's for the industry too. They had an educated, strong, staunch man that was also understanding and wanted to help bridge the gap and improve that education so that we could all sit at the table together equally.
It's amazing, you know, because in your case too, I guess. I mean, because I know I've heard Amelia say, as a woman working in CFMEU gained conditions, has meant that the financial returns for your work has meant that you can run a household in an effective way.
Yes, yes, it has. But it's very hard, which Amelia would 100% know, being in a male-dominated industry. Sometimes it can be a bit difficult. There's those bridges, there's that understanding, there's definitely, and it's so worth it because we've got such good allies and comrades that do want to support us through those times. And the benefits for our family is so worthwhile. I know myself personally, I was the first one in my family to ever own a home. And that was partly due to working in the construction industry and the benefits that we get from that. And that is because of organisers like Joel and the other good ones that the administration have decided, no, they're not good.
Yeah, I think, like, people love to ignore the financial security that a union like CFMEU gets for its members. Like, in other parts of the world, construction workers are really low paid. They're maybe just above minimum wage or even at the minimum. And, like, for women coming into the industry, people of colour coming into the industry who need that financial security, it's invaluable.
I mean, in Italy, the conditions are that they're mostly migrant workers that are either not paid even the award wage or just paid the award wage, and their conditions of safety that or unsafety that, like, the non-safe, unsafe conditions they work in end up leading to their death many times. We're talking about in Italy in the last, so I just say, just because we report on it in Philef, but it's gone up to almost five workers a week.
Oh my God.
Wow.
But we don't have those numbers, even though there are, like, people dying on the jobs here, it's just not at those numbers. But when these organisers and when the shop stewards end up getting, if the community doesn't respond appropriately and support the CFMEU, that is the reality that construction workers could potentially face.
Yeah, and I mean, like, here in Australia, our safety conditions and our pay conditions are really, really good, but there's still a lot of work to do in our industry. And that's why it's so gutting to have lost so many officials with so much experience. You know, like, we still have work to do in terms of changing culture in our industry. But it's not the administration who's going to change culture in our industry. It's our organisers and our union who are doing the work to change it and to improve our conditions.
So where do we go? Where do you guys go from here? Because they've given the black spot to 10 more people as your experienced organisers, and Joel being an incredibly significant person to the Koori people who have been now taking good jobs at on construction sites. What's the future? What do you do?
I mean, I think that although losing these organisers is really gutting, at least there's been a culture of really developing members' skills and education. So it's gutting to lose Joel and other organisers like that, but all the work that he's put into the union and into his membership, I'm sure, is going to see lots of great Koori construction people coming up. And Casey, I think you're one of them.
He's really lit a fire in our community. We haven't had waves like this made for our community since back in the 60s and the 70s, back when the referendum marches were happening, back when our initial Aboriginal orgs were started by the likes of our elders of Uncle Bruce McGuinness, Uncle Jock Austin, Auntie Alma Thorpe, there's heaps more than that. They're just the only ones that are sticking in my head. Joel actually comes from some very strong, staunch women. His grandmother and his mother gave up their time when our very first ever childcare Yapra began, and they helped significantly in that legacy of caring for our youth so that our community could grow, our babies could grow strong, they wouldn't have another stolen generation where we lost our culture. And Joel's carried that legacy on in his own right by guiding the next generation of not just the babies, but the young adults, teaching us, training us, giving us guidance. Even before he jumped into the job role of an organiser 7 years ago, he was my main mentor, teaching me what tickets to go get, what areas are good to work in. For me as a female especially, I might be lacking genetically in some of the strength that the men have physically, but mentally I succeeded in so many other aspects that they couldn't. He was so on the ball with that, and he has done such a great job training up his delegates, and even not just the delegates, but informing and educating the membership as a whole as to what their rights are, what they should be looking for on site, how to look out for each other, because at the end of the day, that's what the union is. It's solidarity on making sure that we all look out for each other, that we're safe and we're going home to our families. But even though he has done a great job, and there is a lot of great potential within our community, his shoes are nearly impossible to fill. He's a once-in-a-generation type of person, that he has all of those boxes ticked, that he really, if he had have been given another 5 years, it would have been so instrumental in really significantly stabilising our community and educating us properly to then be able to carry it on to the best of our abilities. We have had conversations, the delegates and everything. There are people that are like, you know what, I can step up, but it is just so hard to imagine being able to live up to that standard. And Joel is so amazing that he's still would be supportive and be like, what do you mean? Yous have it. If I have it, yous can do it too. Like, he just can see the great potential in everyone. And I think that's where the hard part is. As much as he's done such a great job and he has extremely capable delegates and membership, the idea of how great he is does just sort of still leave that bitter taste in our mouth. We know he trained us up good enough to be able to carry it on and continue what he's done, but it's so devastating to know that he wasn't given the chance to give all that he could.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, but I guess that what we're really saying is that the membership is going to be having to step forward and show the strength of the CFMEU. More power to your arms, you guys.
And we'll have you back for sure.
Yep. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's it for Solidarity Breakfast this morning. We're going to go out with Underdog. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.